Well, what we just want to do now in this point is just say that our experience has been that that Christ does effect conversion in people when they hear of him and meet him through a ministry of love that the church brings. I don't want to give you the impression that all Africans are so thoroughly converted that it hangs out all over all the time. Their church is like our church. We got all kinds of people in it. But always, in every place, there are some who are so thoroughly converted that they become the pivot point, the catalyst for the whole Christian community around them. And this happens. This truly does. It's Paul, you know, says, if any man is in Christ, he's a new creature. The old things are passed away, and all things have become new. I was at Old Onyesambu. We were talking to a man by the name of Musa, who was a Muslim from Arusha, and he's the one I told you about yesterday a little bit, who heard the choir sing. And the choir so enthralled him that he started going back and listening to him, and he was eventually converted through this, and greatly ostracized by his family. They had a funeral service for him, you know, the way the Muslims do, and killed the bullock and everything, and he was sent out to us 25 miles away to get away from some of the pressure. And we usually, before people are baptized, teach them a year and a half. And he says, I don't want any of this. He says, I'm neither fish nor fowl. I'm neither here nor there. I want to be baptized quickly. So we had a crash course. Every evangelist we had there and I, we got together and we taught him every day for 3 months instead of every week for a year and a half. And then shortly before he was to be baptized, I remember I met with him, and his wife had disowned him. He had a wife from Zanzibar, half Arabic, and a little child, and they had gone back to Zanzibar, and his family had disowned him. So I said, Musa, you know, before you go through with this now, are you sure that you want to go through with this? And you've lost your family, everything, are you sure? And he looked me right in the eye and he says, Pastor, what are you talking about? Of course I'm sure. There's nothing I want as much to be a part of Jesus and his community in the world. And he went through with it. And there are things like this that happen all the time. Not all Africans have this type of experience, but there are enough of them to form the nucleus for a new Christian community. Elaine has a story out of the St. Paul insert in the Lutheran that points up Africa's contribution to us in this way. Just let her read it.
Maybe some of you from Minnesota have read this, but I remember seeing it, and I was so struck by it. Kam Hatito came to live with Marlene and Bill Elmstrom and their family 2 years ago. 19 years old, she is the Elmstrom's foster daughter, placed with them by Lutheran Social Service. Kamha's father is an unknown American soldier. Her mother died 5 years ago. She had lived with her grandfather, who was not allowed to leave Vietnam with her. Bill and Marlene Elmstrom were glad to welcome Kamha into their family. They have a married daughter and a daughter, Elizabeth, who is a senior at Forest Lake High School. Bill is retired from the U.S. Army and works as director of shared ministry at Faith Lutheran in Forest Lake. Marlene directs children's and youth choir at the church, serves on the church council and church committees, and works at Northeast Metropolitan Intermediate College. Clearly a welcoming home, clearly a loving home, clearly a Christian home, a good home, surely for a foster child alone in a large, strange country. Kamha is a junior at Forest Lake High School and hopes to become a teacher. LSS had warned the Elmstroms that legally, they could set an example of church attendance for Kamha, but they could not insist that she attend. She expressed no interest and got little out of the few services she attended. She was content to remain apart from that whole part of the family's life, as she did from some other family activities and traditions. But last summer, a visitor from quite a different part of the world lived with the family, and things changed. The Reverend Benjamin Ngedi from the Iringa Diocese in Tanzania served at Faith Lutheran for several months. He stayed with the Elmstroms for a few weeks. Pastor Ngedi engaged Kamha in conversation about her life and her faith. He found that she had in fact been reading her Vietnamese Bible the Elmstroms had provided. After the discussions, Kamha said she wanted to go to church. Soon she asked to be baptized. So on Thanksgiving Day, Pastor Ngedi came back to Faith Lutheran to baptize Kamha Tito into the Christian faith. Needless to say, her foster parents, her Christian educator tutor, Karen Ingoldson, and the entire congregation had reason to give thanks. The service was just a week before Pastor Ngedi returned to Tanzania. Bill Elmstrom is convinced that Pastor Ngedi was placed in their home to minister to their family. I believe that without his intervention, Kamha would not have been baptized on Thanksgiving Day. When I thanked Pastor Ben, he stressed that it was not him, but our Lord working through him. I think we can learn much about mission as a two-way street, Elmstrom insists. We can learn how to express our Christian faith to our friends, co-workers, and neighbors. What we take for granted or are embarrassed to say comes as second nature to this man. His smile was infectious, his openness sincere, and his willingness to talk to anyone about his faith was limitless. Apparently, that willingness to witness also was contagious. Elmstrom learned that Kamha had shared the good news of her baptism with her co-workers, teachers, and friends. Kamha is clearly grateful for the Lord's gift, as her foster family is thankful for Pastor Ngedi's assistance in helping her receive that gift.
It speaks for itself, doesn't it? I mean, just exactly what we're talking about, huh? Now let's move on to take a look at some other aspects of the contribution that Africa may give us. Elaine and I were in 89, in January, we were asked to teach a course in traditional African religion and Christianity's encounter with it at Gustavus Adolphus College in the January term, every day for a month. Huh? And we had 32 students. It was really fun, a great experience. But one of the things that really kind of hit us straight on is the great difference between African and American students as we sort of re-experienced America again during that January term. And the great difference has to do with our relation to the past. American students want all the wisdom of the ages to start with them. And they don't really see why something should come to them from the past. And it seems to me this is a poverty-stricken stance. This is bound to make us poor when this happens. But not so with African students. They value their past and find much of their identity in their past. African culture and religion is resilient. It doesn't mean that they won't receive anything from that which is around them now, but it does mean that they won't throw all of their past away either. And this speaks well for them. I think if we were to put on the board some words that were very important for our American students then when they came to talk about their religion was that it must be personal, and that's okay. There's no problem with that, but it must be so personal that it's also individualistic, and then eventually you get that it's private, huh? And of course, this is nonsense in the Christian faith, huh? When religion is private. Huh? One of the sins of our whole American society is that we think that religion is a private thing. And it'd be better to go back to Constantine's thesis or synthesis than to live with this as though it could be private. And it may be individual, but it's a nasty word, almost. Personal is a good word, but when you go down the line, it gets worse. At least that's the way I look at the vocabulary. Africans, it seems to me, would say it is personal, And certainly there's the aspect of individual. It's never private, and it's never just to this generation. It goes back and includes things. I think they may help us to look at our past with a little more kindness, because you don't often find that among the university set today. The other thing then that we want to look at is that surely one of our first expectations regarding faith and theology in Africa is that it be holistic. That comes from everything we've said so far, isn't it? Where they remember that first day where we talked about how they look at everything in a holistic way. I'll just quote John Mbiti, one of their own theologians. The first way I look at that holistic is the interrelationship of the physical and the spiritual. Here's what he says. Traditional African societies have been neither deaf nor blind to the spiritual dimension of existence, which is so deep, so rich, and so beautiful. The physical and spiritual are but two dimensions of one and the same universe. These dimensions dovetail into each other to the extent that at times and in places one is apparently more real than but not exclusive of the other. To African peoples, this religious universe is not an academic proposition. It is an empirical experience which reaches its height in acts of worship. Well, you can obviously see this is fertile ground for Christian preaching and teaching. Huh? And a church that comes to itself in this environment should then help us to see what holistic really means. And perhaps a church with this background is God's way of challenging us in the West to return to the full gamut of human experience that really should be ours, that includes our spiritual heritage. Because I think we have to admit that at least our higher education philosophy today is not kind to this type of a holistic interpretation of life. The holistic worldview of traditional Africa, and that's why the A, B, C, D are there. Now you can fill them out the way you want it. But the first one was the emphasis of the spiritual and the material melding into one. Huh? Every time you experience the visible world, it is an opening to the invisible world. Huh? And the visible world is made richer because the invisible world impinges on us through that which we touch and see and hear and all this. Huh? The B then would be that the holistic worldview of traditional Africa shows itself in the field of epistemology. This is a big word that simply means how we know. Huh? How do we know? How do we know? Here, holistic means that knowledge, knowing, comes through reason and more than reason. I don't ever want to give the impression that the Africans say reason isn't important. It is. But they would never say that you only know through reason. You know also through intuition, through dreams, through visions, through imagination. All of this plays a part in how we come to know. And here it seems to me that the richness of African tradition serves to accentuate the poverty of the West. If humanity is truly seen as no other, as no more than one aspect of the material world, then knowledge becomes limited to what can be rationally explained and scientifically proven. And this again will force us into a very poverty-stricken type of living. So it seems to me we can expect that Africa's voice in Christian faith and theology will reaffirm the centrality of the spiritual to all of life. Indeed, it's more in line with the worldview that was prevalent when Christianity began to spread around the world. Because even the Greeks said that non-physical reality was more influential on human experience than the physical. Huh? Now, I know that they carry this too far in many ways, but nevertheless, it was a world that made room for that. Well, then an offshoot, and that might be C if you're interested, an offshoot of this how we know is that Christian theology in Africa will not be so disturbed by the worldview that's prevalent in the Bible as we are. You know already what I'm talking about. Huh? Take the book of Acts. Huh? I hear someone one day tried to purge from Acts all of those experiences that have to do with super rational knowing, huh? You know, visions, dreams, prayers, and all this sort of thing. Well, he was left with a pretty slim book. It's like Marcion when he tried to purge the New Testament of everything that had anything to do with the old, huh? And it didn't go over very well. Well, Africa's not disturbed by the Book of Acts, huh? We kind of are. We think, well, maybe it happened then. We even doubt that, but it surely won't happen any time now, huh? That there'll be any of these experiences which you can't explain in a rational way. I don't think the Africans would like to say that the Bible is irrational. It's super rational. Reason is very important in the Bible, but reason has its limits. I mentioned other day a little bit about how we look at the Transfiguration story. We tend to skip over that part where Moses and Elijah and Jesus had a confab, huh, up there, because we don't have room in our worldview for people from the dead talking to other people who are alive and so forth. And we zero in on the last part, which says these kind are healed only by prayer, huh? And we're willing to talk about prayer, huh? Bengt Sundkler from Sweden has written a book. I forget even the name of it. I think it's just Christian Ministry in Africa, and Swahili words keep coming instead of English ones. What do you do when you go around and talk to people? Anyway, he talked to a lot of African pastors as to how they got into the ministry. And he said over 50% said it came through a dream. Their call came through a dream. Well, that doesn't mean it was only a dream. It was consonant with what they'd learned in the Bible and in worship and at home, but yet it came through a dream. One of the first experiences I had in Africa that drew this to my attention was my co-pastor, Simeon Petro, and this was in 1953, when I was still struggling with Swahili. And his wife had had I don't know how many children, and she'd been in the hospital and was told that she should not have any more children. She will not live if she has any more. And so the doctor said that he thought that he should perform an operation on her, but he would have to decide. And he came to me very troubled about this, because this is hard for Africans to take. Anybody, huh? But Africans. But anyway, we talked about it, and I said, you know, you'll have to go home and think and pray about it, because I can't make up my mind for you and your wife. And he came back in the morning. I could tell right away when I saw him that the burden was off him. Huh? And it was off through a dream he had. Now, my Swahili was so poor, I couldn't even get all the dream. It involved flowers and plants and colors and everything. But it meant clearly that he was to have, that they were to have this operation done. Huh? And I wasn't going to argue with him. Huh? Again and again, experiences like this come. We were talking about dreams one time in the Extension Seminary class, and Inea said, well, I want to talk about this. And he said, I have a dream that keeps coming back to me about three times a year, he said. And I dream, I'm sleeping in my little hut and the wooden shutters are open, and in comes a huge butterfly that can hardly get in that big window. And it comes over me and just flutters over me. And I wake up, he says, I am revived. I have love and peace and joy enough to last me again for days. And he says, what is the meaning of that dream? And I said, well, I don't know much about interpreting dreams, but I know that in Christian symbolism, way from the past, a butterfly is a symbol of the resurrection. That's it, he says. I don't need to know anymore. And experiences like this are quite common in the church in Africa. Another offshoot of this regarding the Bible is that whether I was in the residential seminary or the extension seminary work, I never sensed an overwhelming interest in introductory matters as far as the biblical books are concerned. You know, we get so hung up, we got to spend half of the time we have in a book on who wrote it, when, and why. And we never know in the end anyway. But they would say when I would say, well, you know, what's important for you to know is that this whole Old Testament was written by quite a few different people, not just one or two, but a lot of different people, and it was written over a long period of time. And they would say, well, this fits into everything we believe. Why shouldn't it be a community affair that stretches over the generations? Huh? Why should we think that just one person wrote it on? One person might have been wrong, but 50 of them wouldn't have all been wrong. Huh? And then when I tell them that, yeah, but you know, also you got to remember that before it was written down, it went through a lot of oral tradition. He says, aha, that's just the way we did it. Huh? And we like that. Huh? So the introductory material having to do with biblical studies, if it's done rightly in Africa, will be very foopy, huh? Very short. Huh? Very short. Because it doesn't just bother them much, you know. Another offshoot of the holistic thrust of the African church is this. A spin-off of this holistic approach is that the old war between salvation and social work will pass by the way. Huh? How many books have been written and conferences called in America or Europe, not just maybe now so much, but in the years past, where we always had two sides. Well, what are we interested in? The proclamation of salvation or in works of love and service? And we polarize, huh? And this bunch, they're known by this, and this bunch, they're known. And Africa comes and says, what in the world are you talking about? Both of them go together, always, huh? Like I said yesterday, Ethiopia has in its constitution, and other churches have put it there too, now that they never want proclamation without loving service. And they don't want loving service without proclamation. And this is something that we have to learn. You know, we still haven't learned that. And all that we talk about it, I find that we still want to polarize. Huh? We still get hung up on the idea that holistic, you know, holistic in the beginning, when we went there and they thought we did, I don't know how they got that idea, they thought that what we mainly did was just proclaim, huh, and teach. That was never true. There were always schools and hospitals and other things too. But anyway, they thought that, and we came home and they said, you got to be holistic. What does it mean? Well, you got to have a pipe wrench in one hand and a stethoscope in the other, and you got to make sure that you're serving along with this. Huh? Okay, that was learned. Everyone went back and was very concerned that we treat the whole person. But here at home, that has turned around. And holistic means to many people that we go over there with the pipe wrench and the stethoscope, but we don't need the Bible, we don't need the church, we don't need the message of salvation, because we tend to polarize, see? The Africans don't do that. They say you need both, and they can help us understand that we need both. We always need both. Unashamedly, we need both. Otherwise, we're cheating somebody. Huh? Africa's contribution to world Christianity as evidenced in their strong sense of community as it appears in the life of the church. Some of this, we've already talked about it. I can slip over it rather quickly. Probably one of the first things we have to be ready for, but I don't think it'll come real quickly, is it'll mean a difference regarding the communion of saints and All Saints Day. Africa's awareness of the living dead, huh? Those who have gone beyond but are still remembered on earth, is very intense, huh? And the relationship is very real. Many of their dreams, by the way, are, they say, messages from the living dead. This, it seems to me, they're afraid of this now, but now because there are so many things involved with that, sacrificial rites and all that, they're a little afraid of it yet, but they're beginning to say, you know, why do we forget those people? And then they see in the liturgies, you know, I went to an Ash Wednesday service at Luther Northwestern, and I'll read it here. I think what I remember is this. We confessed our sins to God and to each other and to the saints in heaven. Now, that interested me, and that was written in the liturgy in the Lutheran church. Huh? If you can confess to the saints in heaven, someday is going to come when you're going to remember them in some sort of prayer, too. Huh? Anyway, the Roman Catholic idea here is closer to what probably the Africans are going to think about, and we've got to be ready to deal with this. Huh? I don't think that we have to expect them to go back kit and caboodle into their past completely, nor do we have to say that we have to become Roman Catholics in this completely, but nevertheless there should be an enrichment of All Saints Day, huh? And probably other things as well.
That's very strong in Mexico.
Yeah.
Dia de los Muertos, where you will have people go out to the cemeteries and bring food and have a picnic at the cemetery, really with the family buried there and so on. It's a very, very important day to recall the ancestors.
Yeah. Well, I went through the trauma of burning my 3x5 research cards when I did my thesis on Luther out in Africa. But there was one of them in there where I didn't use it in my thesis, but I know one quote was where Luther was asked, what about praying for the dead? And he said, you know, when you lose someone who is close to you, you can't help but pray for them as a Christian. It's the most normal thing in the world. But he said, just do it for a few days and don't make an economic business out of it. And that's as far as I could find what he said about it. Now, by that, I mean, my sister died just recently, and there's no way where you could have stopped me from praying for her the first few days. Huh? In the whole commending of her to God. Well, I think that the African church may contribute something.
Before you leave that, the Japanese have a real sense of who their ancestors were.
Yeah.
And in the Shinto faith and in the Buddhist faith, they pray to their parents and their grandparents and so on. So Christians have backed away from that and said,
that's
we can't pray to the parents and the grandparents, but we can remember them in a creative way.
Right.
And so Christians try to baptize these old ceremonies and make them Christian.
Yeah.
And so they will go to the cemeteries on All Saints Day and they will remember them in the light of God rather than praying to them to pray for ourselves in the light of the ideas that they brought to us.
I remember when I asked Extension Seminary students to tell me, when you have your rituals in your, I mean, not that they were doing it necessarily, I don't know, but when they, in their family, if they had their rituals to remember their dead in the old religion, was it an invitation for them to come and bless you? And most of them laughed. And most of them, no, they said, it was our way of getting them to stay away so they wouldn't bother us. So, but there were a few who said, no, it was an invitation. So they had a little argument, and I suppose that's the way it's going to be. So I don't think you have to worry about that they're going to take the whole thing in. Huh? I remember when Maria, remember her at Madukani? The elders brought a word to me. They came to me, the elders from Madukani came to me and said, Pastor, Maria is having a special commemorative offering in church for her husband who died 10 years ago today. And every year she had something like that. And people are coming to celebrate afterward. We're afraid that she is reverting to the old tradition of ritual sacrifice for her husband. And so I said, well, ask her, I said. So we went and asked her, and she said, oh, it's far from my mind. We had a good husband. The kids had a good father. I just want them to remember him so they don't forget him. And so we had the service. And I mean, we had that part of the service, and we went and helped her to celebrate, you know. So this is the type of thing that maybe is going to happen more and more. Huh? Well, where were we here now? Well, still on community, huh? I think that I mentioned yesterday that the strong sense of community can be expected to speak loud and clear also when it comes to evangelism. When life is lived in community, evangelism follows the line of community, and many people are involved in the witnessing to people, not just one. Huh? This is one of the reasons I think the church is growing in Africa. And their community, their sense of community comes out in the way they deal with things. I remember when two of our members, this was in the 80s, surely, maybe 85 or 6 or something, I don't know. Two of our members were in jail because of shady economic ventures on the border with Kenya. Everybody was always black market stuff, you know. You had to get the most for your goods and that. And well, one of them was in jail because of another reason, too, but I think they held him there longer because of that. Huh? That's what I was told, anyway. They were Lucas and Petro. And then the time came they were to come out of jail. They had been jailed for about a year. And when they were going to come out, the elders at the monthly meeting said, you know, we got to have a celebration to receive them back into the community and the congregation. You know, because after all, the difference between illegality and immorality is often, you know, I mean, it's not, you can't always say because something's illegal, it's immoral. But anyway, it wasn't immoral to them for them to try sell their goat skins to Kenya instead of to Tanzania. And so that wasn't a problem. Anyway, they'd been in jail, never come back. And so they said, here's how we'll do it. First of all, we'll take from our offering money and we'll give a gift to each home to let them know we're interested. And then we'll have a big day when we go around and greet them in their homes. And a specific Sunday after church was designated. And the choirs walked way down to these three homes. And we were along and everybody, and they sang their heart out in every home and we ate in every home. We had a marvelous day, huh? To a time of re-entry into the community, into the congregation. Well, now, how do you handle your jailbirds?
Yeah.
See? I mean, I think that even this is, in a sense, a type of evangelism, huh? When the community sees that when everybody sees that the community is concerned. Another aspect from Christian for Christian faith and theology is that the church as extended family, as community, spreads out theological education to a larger group of people. The evangelists and the church elders must also be theologians, for they deal with the concerns of the local church sometimes even before the pastor knows about it. And they deal with the pastor. They have to handle many marriage showries, marriage cases, or whatever you call a showry. They have to do that often before the pastor even knows about it. And this is why an extension seminary was so important. I always said the next part of the extension seminary has to be a series of courses for the elders. We had them for the evangelists, huh? Because theology is spread out to them. They decide on matters of faith and practice. Our old ensemble church council, about 25 people, men and women, chosen from various geographical areas of the church, because when you walk, you don't play around. You have someone in every area. They came together every Monday, one Monday a month from about 10 o'clock to 2 or 3, huh? To talk about the things of the church. Take this one, for example. A woman comes and says, I am barren. Please allow my husband a second wife so he can have children. And you can say, oh, that's easy. Let her have it. Well, the elders are going to look at this very carefully. They're going to say, as a church, we have decided that the goal of Christian marriage is one husband, one wife. We've done this because we believe the New Testament speaks about this union in a way that talks about love, which is one-to-one rather than one-to-three. Huh? So this is our goal. And they say, also look at this now. What that couple is really saying is really Ki-Africa, huh? Really African. Because they are saying a marriage is not a marriage without children. That's what Africa says. And so we got to admit, we got to decide, does the church agree or doesn't it? And also, Africa says, a person is not an adult until they've had a child. And a woman's person in life is to bear children. Us, that's all. And a healthy life after death means that you have a lot of children who remember you ritually on the grave. And if you don't have that, you got a lousy life after death. So, obviously, he's got to have children. Everything they're asking for when she says, come and give my husband a second wife. Let him have a second wife and me. Everything comes strongly out of that tradition. And no one knows it as well as Africans do. And if they say, if we do that, then we're really saying, let kind of everybody do this when they have problems. And eventually you'll never get a monogamous marriage going in the church. Well, anyway, all I'm saying is that these people are theologians. Theology is spread out to include the elders and the evangelists, not just the pastor. And this seems to me is a good thing. And these Christians struggle with the forming of a synthesis between the old and the new in Africa. They want to be, in some sense, at least authentically African, and yet sensitive to the newness of Jesus as Lord, and alert to the changes all around them. And I don't think there's any group in the church in Africa that is as formative of Christian practice as the elders in session.
How did they decide that?
Well, on that one, well, they decided that he couldn't have a second wife. Yeah. And it was really hard. Christopher comes to church every Sunday, regular as can be. But he's a second-class Christian, in a sense, because he has taken a second wife. You know, he has one. He isn't a communing Christian. Can't be a communing Christian. The marriage is never blessed. He comes, but he can't be communing. And that's awful. You know, as a pastor, that hurt me a lot. But I don't know what the answer is. I certainly am not going to go contrary to what the elders decide in something like this. Because then you got real problems.
Is there any activity in the area of adoption?
Oh, yeah. We've tried all that and everything. It's not very easy in Africa. First thing, there aren't many to adopt because the extended family takes any child it needs.
This is going to change, though, like in the western part of Tanzania, because of AIDS, which has hit that part of the country, there are going to be thousands of homeless children without extended family to take care of them. So that may change, and there will be ways in which other parts of the country have enough children.
All right, we got to turn it off now. I would just say a third expectation of Christian theology has to do with the sacraments. First of all, infant baptism. Now, I don't say that's a problem here particularly, but infant baptism seems so powerfully right because of the closeness of the family and the pervasive influence of the family on the children. I can't imagine going as a Baptist missionary to Africa. You have to have a dedication service which is tantamount to baptism, which of course they do, you know. But the infant baptism seems so right because in the old, the burying of the placenta in a certain place and way, the naming of the child, all that were ways where the child was accepted into the African community right away. And now baptism is a way where the child is accepted into the community and then is reared in the faith. Holy Communion, I would simply say that I remember I told you yesterday what Olosiki said, so I won't repeat that as a student, but Lesion, he said, Jesus was a member of the living dead for 2 days. And on the third day, he was raised to full life. The first one to ever be raised to this life. So he now comes back to us in the sacrament and meets us in the fellowship of the church. It seems to me that since sacrifice and the sacrificial cult life is in traditional Africa is so important, that I think we will see coming from there a tremendous emphasis on the Eucharist as fulfilling these sacrifices and transforming these religious rites into the celebration of the one great sacrifice for the sins of the world. But anyway, sacrifice as a whole, as a theme, as a topic, as a reality, sacrament as a reality is not something strange to African thinking at all. Their whole life has been lived with the idea that everything visible is a door or a window that opens you up to the invisible. Huh? And that's kind of what a sacrament is. Okay, comments? Questions? Yeah?
You mentioned that the elders would not permit this man whose wife was barren.
Yeah.
Would not permit him to take the Holy Communion.
Well, they wouldn't permit him to, the first thing you say, they wouldn't permit him to take, they wouldn't permit him to take a second wife. He can have Holy Communion as long as he wants to, as long as he doesn't take a second wife.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Well, that was it.
Yeah, yeah. See,
so the second marriage resulted in children, because maybe he was the one.
Yeah, that's always a problem. Huh? Actually, it did, though. She was the one from Kenya, wasn't she? Oh, no, the one from Kenya is the one, the first one. The second one had children. Yeah, he had children. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a very profound statement. You just said everything visible is an open window to the invisible. How, from your perspective, to the African contribution to our understanding, how could we incorporate this into our institutional structure in such a way that the visible would be an open window to the invisible? It seems to me this is the key challenge to the church today.
Well, Norm, I don't think that the structures, the institutional structures, are the way it's going to come necessarily. But, I talked about this so many times that I think I talked to everybody about it, and I maybe haven't. Huh? But one of the things that that hits you when you come from Africa to America is that you fear that we have lost our belief that there really is a spiritual dimension to life. You fear that people are really only whistling in the dark when they come to church, hoping that it might be true. But many think that there's nothing. When you die, you're gone, that's all. And there is nothing such as God. And I think that is because we have adopted pretty much a materialistic worldview in which the trinity of reason, science, and technology have so encapsulated us in the space-time box that we really kind of wonder if there is anything more to life than that which you can prove in a test tube or by a logical syllogism. Now, here is where Africa has to challenge us. Huh? And, of course, obviously, this isn't quite true. Huh? You know, all of America doesn't believe that. But I am convinced that our educational philosophy is thoroughly pagan. That we don't have room for God. And we on a higher level at least, it's easier to be a Marxist. That's an outmoded term. But it's easier to be a Marxist than a Roman Catholic or a good Lutheran in our universities today. And so it seems to me what we got to do is just say, this just isn't true. Huh? This just isn't true. God is. Huh? Now, you can't prove that logically. It's an act of faith. And you don't retreat and say, I won't dare use my reason. You use your reason. Look at the history of the church. The greatest people to use their reason were the medieval scholastics. Huh? All of them Christians. And sometimes I think they used it too much. But anyway, they used it. Huh? And we've got to say, we are neither or. We aren't people who aren't going to use our reason, but neither are we people who are going to deny that there is a spiritual reality of life. And this is why we get hung up, I think, so much on wanting to solve the questions, even the questions that we've had here at Holden this week. And I think they're the right questions. I have no problem with that at all, Captain. We try to solve first. What about the other religions? And we want to solve it in a logical way. Huh? You can't do that. Life isn't
that logic. Well, haven't you found that out? Look at, behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. How logic is it? How much logic is it? I hope not too illogical, but at least it's super logical. Huh? Logic goes so far, reason goes so far, but there are other parts of life. And that's where, Norm, I think we have to just hang on to it, that's all. And there are some areas in which I think we're winning it. Now, that opens the door to any religion. Then the second step is that I believe that the only way to walk safely in the world of the Spirit is with your hand in Jesus Christ's hand. The world of the Spirit is powerful. I will never for one minute try to tell you that there is nothing to witchcraft, for example, in that. Ah, don't you believe that, huh? But the only way to walk safely in that world of the Spirit is through the one who is victorious over principalities and powers. That's what that means, by the way. Then put your hand in his and walk with confidence. Huh? But don't for one minute let people play with you with those powers unless you are in Jesus Christ, because you'll be worse off than you were before. And here is where I think that there are many forces that are coming together in America today to help us to realize, yes, God is, huh? And he speaks to us. He is not silent. And we can say this unashamedly. Huh? And it's part of our faith and part of our witness. Yeah, I told you, once I get started in this, I get a little hot.
Good.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Anything else you want to say? Well, we're going to...
I was thinking one thing about the Africans, too. They don't know their birthdays, but they know their baptism day. And they always remember
that. Yeah. Yeah, if you ask them when they were born, they say, well, I was born here, we had a good peanut crop. Or something like that. But their baptism, they got a record, huh? And they know. And they keep their baptism.
Yeah.